Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Snyder, who's a Senior Fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of South Korea at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rising Regional Rivalry. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Kim Jong-un's Trap for South Korea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Snyder.
Glad to be here.
So the New Year's offer in the speech by North Korea's Kim Jong-un, you're suggesting in your article, or making pretty clear, I think, in your article, that this is an attempt to put President Moon Jae-in of South Korea in an impossible bind. Obviously, the idea of a peaceful Olympics is a veiled threat, but that's not anything new from the North. But also, how is he planning on tying that together with a celebration of the 70th anniversary of North Korea's founding?
Well, that's what's really interesting about the speech, is that Kim Jong-un does identify a common interest that both North and South Korea have in maintaining peace and stability on the peninsula for South Korea in order to host the Olympics successfully, but for North Korea in order to host the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the date of which is September 9th. And so essentially what that means is that Kim Jong-un is suggesting that military exercises that the U.S. and South Korea do twice a year be essentially deferred during 2018 and essentially canceled for this year. And I think that's where essentially South Korea is going to face a lot of pressure and the potential for opening a gap with the United States, because I doubt that the Trump administration is going to go for a cancellation. They might have been willing to defer the spring exercises by a month, but I doubt that the U.S. is going to sign on to a complete deferral of exercises during the year 2018.
Well, of course, there is this freeze-for-freeze offer out there by the Russians and the Chinese, which I think the South Koreans are entertaining it, aren't they?
Well, the South Koreans, I think, have lined up with the United States. I'm not sure they've got much choice on this.
Right.
And the U.S. has said that they're not going to go for the dual suspension of exercises and testing. And the main hang-up, I think, that Washington has with that proposal is that it sacrifices military readiness, which is something that is a normal aspect of maintaining deterrence against an adversary, in exchange for a set of activities that North Korea is not supposed to be doing in the first place, and that it's been declared illegal by the UN Security Council. So it's an uneven trade.
Right. But isn't the whole leverage that North Korea has is essentially an attempt at deterrence against an attack by the U.S. That's the idea of turning Seoul into a sea of fire is their hedge, right? Which makes it very difficult for the U.S. to do anything militarily about the growing nuclear threat from North Korea. I mean, there's talk of all kinds of strategies and possibilities, and the latest is the idea that somehow we could give the North Koreans a bloody nose. But when you talk about deterrence, who's got the upper hand there?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that both sides have been deterring each other for decades. The North Koreans have used that threat of retaliation against Seoul as their insurance against prevention of a U.S. conventional attack for decades. And the U.S. And South Korean combined military presence, defensively postured, is sufficient to deter the prospect of a North Korean attack. And so that conventional deterrence has remained in place and has been stable for a long time. Really, the new feature, I think, is that North Korea has attempted to, from their perspective, even the playing field in terms of nuclear deterrence, where they've lived with a U.S. threat for a long time. Now they claim, with their new nuclear capabilities, to be able to deter the United States from conducting offensive military operations against North Korea, which I don't think the United States would have been considering in the first place were it not for the new development of vulnerability to a potential North Korean nuclear attack.
Well, but that's where there's some question, surely, Scott Snyder, is whether the North Koreans have actually got deterrence by threatening the United States. It clearly has a lot of people bothered in this country, doesn't it? Not the least of which is President Trump himself, who's made some extremely rash statements about the fellow that he calls Rocket Man.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The new feature is that, I mean, North Korea has lived with this sense of vulnerability to a U.S. nuclear attack capability for such a long time. From Pyongyang's perspective, it seems perfectly natural to want to even the playing field. But, of course, from a political perspective, if you're in the United States, the idea of being vulnerable to a nuclear attack by Kim Jong-un just seems like an unnecessary and undesirable risk. And so it has essentially created a debate within Washington over whether nuclear deterrence that had existed during the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and between the U.S. and China can or will hold with an individual and a country like North Korea. And clearly, President Trump is one who has suggested that the capability itself poses an unacceptable danger to the United States. Others in the defense community would argue that, well, you know, we can check North Korea's potential use of nuclear weapons because we would hold their survival at risk if they were to conduct such an attack. And the one thing that we can say about Kim Jong-un, quite the opposite of what President Trump said, is Rocket Man is not on a suicide mission. He's pursuing regime survival. In fact, he's pursuing an expanded role for his country based on enhanced capabilities.
So what can be walked back on the part of, I mean, obviously North Korea is a dictatorship and, you know, from cradle to grave, these people are brainwashed by the regime. And it is a disgusting kleptocracy, family dynasty. There's nothing, we could spend the next hour talking about how dreadful it is, but at some point or other, you've got to figure out how to deal with them. There have been some suggestions that the Chinese, for the longest time, have played a kind of game where they promised to do something but did nothing, because at the end of the day, maybe they don't mind the idea that there's this wild card that's driving the U.S. crazy and making their military assets in the Pacific vulnerable. But I think that at this point, the dynamics have changed, haven't they, where there's a lot of pressure on China to do something, and China's obviously not entirely complying because they've been doing these oil offloads at sea with, you know, North Korean tankers meeting Chinese tankers and other flag tankers offshore and filling up. So what's your read on how different it is? In other words, I can't imagine the Chinese are happy about the response from the U.S. putting more military assets into that neighborhood, the possibility of South Korea wanting, certainly they're building up their military and their defenses, and they're even talking about going nuclear, and Japan's even talking about going nuclear. So for China, North Korea's creating a lot of problems, isn't it?
Certainly North Korea's nuclear and missile development is the core source of increasing uncertainty geopolitically in Northeast Asia. And we can see how North Korea's nuclear capability is generating potential doubts about the credibility of U.S. assurances about extended deterrence, the willingness by the United States to come to the defense of Japan and South Korea against a nuclear-capable North Korea. And then also, in terms of China's response, I think that what we have is a situation where in previous administrations, the United States has sought China's cooperation to work together with the United States on pressuring North Korea. But China has its own interest in maintaining stability on the Korean Peninsula, and they're unwilling to press North Korea to the level that the U.S. would like to press North Korea in order to induce some kind of reversal of direction in North Korea's nuclear program. And so now I think under the Trump administration, we have begun to see evidence that the United States might be willing to take self-defensive measures, especially on the economic side, through secondary sanctions application against North Korea. And the United States is pressing China harder in terms of what the expectations are through the UN Security Council resolutions. You're right that the United States is also signaling potentially a willingness to use military resources, in part possibly as a means by which to impress upon China the need to weigh in with North Korea in order to avert military conflict between the United States and North Korea. And I think it's debatable whether those particular signals have really been successful in motivating China, but certainly we can see that the order that has existed around the two Koreas is being stressed by this development, the origin of which is North Korea's nuclear and missile development.
Well, as far as I can see, there isn't a lot that can be done by China. They certainly don't want the country, North Korea, to collapse and have the U.S. military on the Yalu River again, as they did when they ended the Korean War. And so the question would be then, is there anything the Chinese can do? Now, obviously, they've gone along with the sanctions, and there's an oil embargo, which really, I think, really is something that could really hurt the North Koreans and certainly hurt their military capability. But now they're doing this offshore smuggling that I mentioned earlier with the tankers, etc. At the end of the day, is there any realistic possibility of the Chinese engineering some regime change? I know I'm assuming that the reason that Kim Jong-un murdered or assassinated his half-brother with VX binary gas, which was a pretty provocative thing to do, and the murdering of the uncle who was the liaison to Beijing has something to do with Kim Jong-un's fear that the Chinese might engineer regime change. Is there any realistic possibility? Because to my mind, the only way that you're going to have any peace in that part of the world is to get rid of this horrible regime. Either the Chinese are the only ones who could do it, as far as I can tell, or two, somehow or other, accepting their existence and doing what happened with the Soviet Union, with glasnost and perestroika. Once you open it up, then the whole Potemkin village collapses, as happened with the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with the prospect of China's direct intervention in order to secure a regime transition in North Korea is that the Chinese-North Korean relationship has always been full of tension and hostility, even when North Korea and China were putative allies. They didn't necessarily get along with each other so well. And so I think that the Chinese concern about the risks of backfire or backlash that could occur as a result of a unilateral intervention by China are just so great that they're not willing to entertain them. What is interesting, however, is that the Chinese military may have begun to prepare some plans for limited intervention in North Korea in the event of instability as a way of trying to restore some kind of stability on the peninsula. And then also, after having resisted contingency planning talks with the United States for a long time, it appears that the U.S. and China have opened a dialogue about how to deal with that prospect. And so those are developments that I think constitute additional hedges against the uncertainty of outcomes related to what might happen with North Korea. Of course, also in a way, I think represent the discomfort that both the U.S. and China have with the idea of a nuclear North Korea under Kim Jong-un kind of remaining and continuing to grow as a source of regional threat and instability as their nuclear capabilities continue to grow.
So what about the other possibility, which is a policy of containment and engagement? containment via the U.S. military and its alliances, and engagement, I imagine, largely through South Korea. Because one of the things that I've learned over the years talking to specialists on Korea is that the regime most fears that their people will figure out what a bad deal they're getting. And South Korean soap operas are extremely subversive in that regard. And I think going back to the analogy with the Soviet Union, was MTV and rock and roll may have done more to unhinge the Soviet Union than our strategic nuclear forces. So what about the possibility of trying to undermine that regime by cooperating with it, raising the standard of living a little, helping the people in North Korea have a better life, and eventually, I mean, if you accept the idea that that was what largely brought about the end of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. So in a way, I think what is really interesting about the North Korea situation that most North Korea watchers actually ended up missing is that Kim Jong-un's embrace of the markets within the course of the past 5 years has actually enabled North Korea's nuclear and missile program to grow at a faster rate than it did under Kim Jong-il. And so essentially what that means is that North Korea has increased its economic interdependence through embedded relationships, supply chain relationships with China, at the same time that it has maintained its political isolation. And really, I think that what we need to see with North Korea is both economic interdependence and political integration. Essentially, this current situation allows Kim Jong-un to be a parasite on the region, but to maintain the conditions that allow his political legitimacy to remain unchallenged. Whereas those other sources of information flow into North Korea that would come with political integration actually do constitute a potential source of risk that the regime is highly sensitive to, and in fact has tried to introduce countermeasures in order to try to stem. So for instance, if you're in North Korea, they now have state uses of technology that enable authorized computers to erase unauthorized content or to enhance the ability of the state to watch and oversee content that North Koreans might be trying to access outside of North Korea.
Well, Scott Snyder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Snyder, who's a senior fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of South Korea at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rising Regional Rivalry. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Kim Jong-un's Trap for South Korea. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.